Welcome to Lux Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As the coronavirus pandemic transforms our increasingly surreal reality, there is much confusion, misinformation, and abject fear that gets in the way of seriously tackling this crisis. Of course, the confuser-in-chief is a primary culprit in spreading dangerous misconceptions and lies, and makes it that much more difficult for all of us to get a handle on what is really happening and what needs to be done immediately. So it's time to turn off the orange clown and talk with an epidemiologist. Today we are fortunate to have with us Deborah Davis, president of the Environmental Health Trust, to guide us through scientific explanations of the epidemiology of COVID-19 and safe practices to flatten the pandemic's curve and find a way to the other side of this nightmare. Deborah, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you so much, Barbara. Delighted to talk with you.
Well, it's been a long time since we talked. Must have been at least 10 or 12 years. And at that time, you were dealing with particulate pollution, it seemed. And I think you're one of the first people to raise concerns about some of this fine particulate pollution that's really harming people. So now we're stuck in a different kind of pollution, which is something totally invisible, or at least until you have a microscope, and is a pandemic that's on the scale of something that none of us have seen in our lifetime. I'm kind of curious how you go from dealing with particulate pollution to dealing with a pandemic in your work.
Well, it's all a question of understanding patterns that occur in people's health and disease and their relationship to the environment around them. And so whether or not it's ultrafine particulate air pollution from coal-fired power plants and coke ovens, or whether or it is a viral contamination that's spread from person to person by human contact, it's all the same set of tools that we use to look at these patterns and get clues about ways that we can prevent and reduce the burden of disease for the human population.
What are the biggest challenges right now to understand what's going on with the coronavirus, to track it and to try to control it?
One of the biggest problems we face now is that millennials came away initially with the idea that they were somehow immune or invulnerable and not affected by this virus. What we now know from data from China and Italy and Korea is that in the age group 20 to 54, there is a great vulnerability, and this constitutes about a fifth of all cases that get into the hospital. And it was a mistake in the beginning to create the impression that the millennials were invulnerable, and that mistake was created in part because in China there has been a one-child policy, and so that generation was a smaller proportion of their population than in other parts of the world. So the first assumptions were correct, that the elderly would be more vulnerable to face more serious complications, but younger adults also face complications, and we recently had a 21-year-old soccer coach die in England.
One of the things that seems to be a problem in this country is that young people don't seem to understand that both they're at risk, and secondly, which seems to be even a greater factor, they can be carriers and they can put the rest of the country at risk.
Well, you're absolutely correct, Barbara. There's a new study just released in The Lancet showed that the majority of the carriers of the disease have been asymptomatic when they have spread it, and that's for two reasons. First, viral shedding, when you are most contagious, occurs in 24 to 48 hours before you have symptoms, so you don't even know that you're sick. And second, it's because a lot of people who will be going out not knowing that they have the virus and will have, even when it's active, will have almost no symptoms other than perhaps a slightly irritated throat. So there's a wide range of responses, and because of this, the Imperial College of London that did the original calculations and that analyzed their assumptions and have determined that the virus is even more contagious than was originally thought. So it's really important that we communicate to young people that they're not impervious.
Well, one of the things that seems to be a challenge for people is being able to understand how the virus is transmitted. And let's talk a bit about like how it lives, what surfaces it lives on longer, and what are the best precautions.
The major route of exposure is from touching a contaminated surface that a droplet of the virus has come onto because someone has sneezed or coughed. That is still the major area. So keeping surfaces clean meaning cleaning them and then disinfecting, which you can do with 70% isopropyl alcohol or a spray of Clorox and mostly water that you make, is the best thing to do. However, a study was done in a laboratory that basically put the virus in the equivalent of a can of hairspray, puffed it into the air in an artificial circumstance to see how long it could stay in the air under that circumstance. And they were somewhat surprised to see that it could be in the air for up to 3 hours. But when you cough or sneeze, you are not a spray can of hairspray. And so there's a lot of question about how relevant that is to transmission, and it is generally believed by most infectious disease epidemiologists with the CDC and World Health Organization that primary transmission is from person to person through leaving droplets on surfaces, and that is why every common surface that you encounter, a doorknob, the exit to the bathroom, an entrance to a store, you either have to use your elbow, a glove, or something to get opened, or after you've had contact with it, you must wash your hands with warm, soapy water, thoroughly getting in between the fingers and up on the thumbs, or using a disinfectant which with aloe vera and alcohol, which is not as effective as basic hand washing, by the way. It's a mistake to think that you need to use that skin-drying stuff all the time, when in fact soap and water, then drying your hands with, unfortunately, either a paper towel or a towel that is unique to you in your household. I recommend that for everyone, no matter who you're living with, no matter how long, keep your own towel for this period of time right now. If you do those things, that's going to reduce the chance of transmission. But the primary route is surface contact, although under some circumstances, if you were to simply walk right by within perhaps a few minutes of someone's sneezing into that particular zone, there's a possibility of airborne transmission, but the majority of transmission is surface.
How much more dangerous is it to be outside with to be inside with people than it is to be outside?
Well, we know that indoor air recirculates, and unfortunately, we spend 90% of our time in the indoor environment, and now it may be even worse. It's even more important now for people to get outside for an hour a day and get 20 minutes of sunlight to try to stimulate vitamin D where you live in a place that's not rainy and you can do that. Being outdoors is good for the soul, and it's good for you as well. The indoor environment, it depends on what control you have over it. Certainly, we know in certain workplaces, workers have raised really important concerns about the inability to have a safe indoor environment, given that sometimes the production lines have people closer than 6 feet together.
One of the things that I've noticed is I'm outside, because I try to get outside every day, and we have a wetland that we can go walking in the neighborhood. And some days it's been pretty crowded, and the trail is a little bit narrow, and I have to be really careful. And some people are very conscious and will go to the far side of the trail that they're on. And other people were still reminding them about the 6-foot rule, and they don't seem to get it. But one of the concerns I had a few weeks ago when I'd passed somebody, there was like one guy one day who was walking towards me talking about what a beautiful day it was and how great everybody was out enjoying it. And I was afraid of his breath, expelling breath into my face as I walked by. And I'm wondering, was that kind of an overblown concern?
What can I say? I think we will only know the answer to your question next year. For now, it seems to me it's overblown. And I think, you know, we have to try to lead as normal a life as we can. And that means, you know, there's advice on one of the most important things I can tell everybody is get dressed in the morning. Any place to go, get dressed. Treat yourself as though you are going someplace, having something to do, and make sure that you do that.
Why is it that soap is such an effective way of getting the virus off of your hands and breaking down the virus?
Well, it's basically that the virus doesn't like the pH and the bubbles of the soap. And so soap is a much better way to get rid of it. You will reduce it with the hand sanitizers, but the soap and water is the most efficient because you get the soap and you get the flow of the water as well.
Well, let's talk about the necessity for social distancing and some of the resistance that we're getting towards that, particularly from the guy who's in the White House right now. Why is social distancing so important at this point?
Because as far as we know, that is the only thing that will be guaranteed to ensure that you're not going to be exposed. The reason is the majority of the people carrying this virus are asymptomatic. The majority of the people transmitting it have no symptoms. So you have to assume that everyone you encounter, frankly, has COVID-19 virus. And if you get closer than 6 feet, the possibility of exposure through exhaled material is real. And in fact, if you sneeze, it's almost impossible for your sneeze droplets to travel more than 6 feet. And that's the basis for the rule.
A number of states now have stay-at-home policies. Some call them shelter-in-place. Oregon is one of them. I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly how many states have it right now. But it seems that Donald Trump is trying to limit that rule. I was wondering what your response was to his statement a couple days ago that the country would be open for business by Easter, which is just a couple weeks away.
As Dr. Fauci, I think, eloquently pointed out, it's nice to have hopes and aspirations, but we've got to deal with reality. And the reality is that's not happening. And if it were to happen, if you were to flood the churches for Easter, you would be spreading the virus, and we would end up with well over 1 million deaths in this country. So I understand why the president said it. On the other hand, it's not consistent with any public health recommendations, and I hope that he will listen to the public health experts, because I cannot imagine any of them telling him this is a good idea.
Now, what do you think about the idea of having these different zones? He's talking about designating which are high-risk zones in the country and which aren't. And I'm wondering what your response to that is.
We are a very large country. So if you had a zone that you said it was relatively okay for people to socialize within, you'd have to then have everybody stay in that zone and not leave it. And you would not have, and you could not allow anybody else to come into it from outside. So it doesn't make sense in a country with as much mobility as we have had. Now, having said that, if there's a small area where there's been absolutely no infection and people are trying to socialize, that may be okay for that small group in that small area, as long as they don't go out and have anybody else come in. But we don't live like that. What the Chinese did in order to get on top of the infection, and what they did in Singapore as well, they went house to house, they found anybody with a fever, they removed them, sometimes forcibly, from their homes, put them in fever hospital hotels where they were specially housed, and then monitored them to see, did they have the COVID virus, did they have influenza A or B, and only when the fever was gone were they permitted to go back to their homes. And everybody had a cell phone with a color on the screen, basically like green, yellow, red. If your phone was red, you can't go anywhere. And you had to show that in order to be allowed to enter any public venue at all. Now, in the United States, those things are not going to happen. So we are asking people, please stay home. Please avoid social contact. Give us another month, I think, and let's see where we are. If we can flatten the curve, meaning lower the rate of increase. That's what that term means. The rate of increase has been, unfortunately, doubling every few days in some of our large areas, in particular in New York. It's his hardest hit right now and has many, many cases, and they're close to capacity. But having said that, I think that the best thing we can do is social distancing right now, because if we try to open up one section of the country, I think we'll simply be spreading it all over the place in short order.
Well, I often feel, living here in Portland, and particularly the neighborhood I live in, that I live in kind of a bubble. And things feel very conscious. My neighbors are being really conscious. We have a little social hours together. They stand on their porch. We're on the sidewalk. And it's sort of helping us get through this time. But I've heard stories from other parts of the country. We were talking to a friend in San Francisco yesterday who said that people are not really respecting the social distancing or staying at home, even though they have what they're calling a shelter-in-place order in California. And he said that every day he has a different mail carrier, and they're just throwing the mail over the fence, maybe making it to his front porch, maybe winding up in the street. So it sounded pretty chaotic there. And then my partner was also talking to her sister in Seattle yesterday, which is one of the hardest hit areas. And it sounded, again, like there was not a whole lot of respecting of social distancing. And there's a homeless guy living in the doorway of her building. And the store that's on the ground floor of the building, there's no measures at all to keep the customers separate. So I wonder, even though we have these orders in place, how do we get people to understand the importance of respecting them?
I don't know that I know enough to be able to answer that question. We have to keep a drumbeat of information. We make sure everybody understands you are at risk. You should assume you have the virus, and you want to protect. You don't want to kill your grandparents. We have to get through to the millennials and make sure they understand that one out of five people in intensive care now is under age 64. We need to make sure they understand they are not immune.
Well, another thing that here what I'm seeing in Portland, there's some stores that I feel pretty comfortable still going into, though I'm really trying to limit how many errands I run and how frequently I go to the grocery store. But they are taking very seriously social distancing, and they make you wait outside 6 feet apart. At some places, they have orange circles, other places, green circles where you stand. But my partner, again, went into Fred Meyer's, the largest supermarket chain here in Portland and across actually the Northwest. And she said there were no measures being taken there at all. And there was no line to get in. People were just kind of coming in willy-nilly. It wasn't really crowded, but it was kind of disconcerting that she didn't feel that same kind of caution. So again, it seems that even though we have a state order that basically really limits what businesses can be open and has very strict requirements for what businesses do if they are open, it seems not to be being respected by this very large grocery chain. So again, I wonder how the public health message gets out to the wider public.
Ideally, we have a federal government that gives one message to everyone. What we have instead is this dog-eat-dog world where the states are competing with one another for respirators and masks because we lack a coherent federal leadership. There should be federal rules about this. No store should be allowed to have more than X number of people in relative to its square footage space. That's very simple. And there has to be, information has to be publicly provided. Frankly, I know Portland is a bit of a bubble, a wonderful one in many ways, but I think that the citizens of Portland are going to be up for a very nasty surprise if they don't pay attention to the fact that the virus is so much more broad spread than we know, and that those who have any chronic illness, whether asthma or heart disease or, frankly, obesity, diabetes, should be especially careful because they will be at highest risk, according to what we know from the data. And remember, every day the data are changing a little bit. We have new information from China. That's how we found out that the majority of the carriers have no symptoms.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with epidemiologist Dr. Devra Davis, who is providing scientific explanations of the epidemiology of COVID-19 and safe practices to flatten the pandemic's curve and find a way to the other side of this nightmare. Well, it's been interesting that Oregon has had so fewer cases that have been diagnosed than either California or Washington, who were the original two hotspots. But part of the reason seems to be that Oregon has also had a very hard time getting test kits. And now that there's a lot of testing going on, we have a lot more cases. And in fact, I think there was about a 25% increase in cases between 2 days ago and yesterday. What does that say about how we contract this, and also raises the question of the scarcity of testing kits and the kind of triage that's going on with testing? Because I understand that in countries in Asia, everybody or a very large percentage of the population was getting tested.
Right. Korea was able to test most people right away. And that's something that we need to be asking ourselves. Why did we not have that capacity? When you hear talk that we have done more tests than Korea, that's true, but that's only because we're a bigger country. But in fact, as a proportion of the population, we are woefully behind. You're absolutely right that Portland area may look good right now for the COVID-19 because you haven't been able to test. And there's a Chinese proverb that a way of looking is a way of not looking. And if you don't want to find something, you don't ask. So it's been a kind of perverse don't ask, don't tell policy with COVID-19. And I think Portlanders are going to be in for a big surprise soon.
There's been this dilemma. I was reading a few days ago that a lot of public health officials are saying that we should really prioritize testing for people with symptoms and that we shouldn't just be testing everybody because there aren't enough masks and there aren't enough gowns. What sense does that make?
They're correct. We can't afford right now to test everybody because then we would be missing the six people who need the most help. That's an indication of our failure to plan adequately for this disaster. And, you know, another guy in the Northwest warned about the need to plan for global pandemics 5 years ago. His name was Bill Gates, and he was not paid attention to, as we all know. And he warned that it was just a question of time before something like this hit. I happen to know that one of the high priority items on which President Trump was briefed by the Obama transition and by the President Obama himself was the need to plan for a global pandemic. And it is true the Obama White House was rather large, and Trump cut staff, and he unfortunately cut this staff. But the reality is we failed to prepare for this as a nation, and now we're paying the price. But the lack of information on cases in Portland right now is principally due to the lack of testing. And you also tend to be, as a group, people who are more interested in the outdoors and staying healthy. And I would say this about going outside. Go outside, but keep your distance. And if someone's too close to you, you can say, I'm trying to stay healthy. Please keep away. There's nothing wrong with making sure that you communicate that.
There's basically two groups of people that I'm meeting when I go walking. And the larger group are people we have, I'm calling it the COVID-19 smile. We kind of give each other a smile and a nod as we step as far apart from each other as we can. And I feel this really amazing camaraderie, and I really appreciate it. And I thank all my neighbors for that. And then there are a few people who refuse to budge. And when I say that we need to be 6 feet apart, they give me this look of either disdain or who cares. There's one person who told us the other day he didn't need a lesson. He didn't want us to teach him anything.
Oh. A lesson? For goodness sakes, it's not a lesson. It's survival. And I think that we just have to have polite things. I think the gesture of putting your hands together in namaste or the peace sign or whatever we can to communicate that we're all in this together, that we should be grateful that we are well, if we are, and that we're gonna come through it. But the idea of chafing that this is a lesson. Look, you're entitled. You have the right to walk outdoors and not be encroached upon by someone who might be endangering your health. They're actually in Britain. They're prosecuting someone who had the virus and deliberately went around coughing on people. Was obviously mentally not very stable. So now this is serious. And we have to take it very seriously.
One of the things that you've been writing about in the last few weeks has to do with the connections between the virus and living in very polluted areas. So I want to talk a little bit about what you see as the connection between really bad pollution.
When I first saw the data from China, my husband and I have been visiting professors at Sichuan University in Chengdu, which is one of the largest westernmost cities in China. I also have worked closely with colleagues in Iran, and I knew that both of those places had among the highest rates of smoking tobacco in the world. And the Lancet, they reported that 1 in 10 men are Chinese in the world, but they smoke a third of all cigarettes in the world. So China is on target to have more than 2 million lung cancer deaths from smoking alone. We know that from the work of Professor Richard Pito and Professor Zhengmin Cheng in China. I also had done work for more than 30 years on air pollution in China. And I looked, just kind of curious, at an air pollution map, because you can get real-time air pollution data from Hebei, which is the province where Wuhan is, which is where the center of the epidemic is. And I noted that the levels of air pollution in Hebei reported by the Chinese authorities with their own data are, in fact, among the highest in the world that are reported today. Now, I want to stress that because we don't get reports from Iran and we don't get reports from mid-sized cities in India, where I think the levels are also quite high. Hebei is the center of steelmaking, coke ovens, And we know that those are among the most dirty, polluting sources in the world. Air pollution is an important thing for our lungs and for our bodies, and we know that ultrafine air pollution gets all the way in, past the nose, into the lung, and can slip into the bloodstream, and has huge effects on every system in the body that's been studied so far. So because of that, I then put together an analysis of what were these cofactors for pollution, and what I concluded is that the tobacco smoking, both in Iran, certainly in China, as well as, by the way, northern Italy and Korea, they have very, very high rates of tobacco smoking, and that all of these things can worsen the status of the lungs of anybody. In fact, in Wuhan, just breathing the outdoor air, if you were not a cigarette smoker, was equivalent to smoking 2 to 4 packs of cigarettes a day.
Is it just because one's lungs are so compromised by inhaling so much pollution, or is there some other kind of symbiotic relationship?
Sure. What happens is this. You know you have nose hairs. They're very, very valuable, and they're equivalent of invisible hairs called cilia lining the whole tract from the lungs all the way up into the nose and the sinuses. And those cilia, their job is like a little escalator, and they work when you're not smoking tobacco and when you're not breathing polluted air. Your cilia work to get rid of the bacteria and viruses that you come in contact just because you're alive and breathing. Normally, they are moist and effective and working, and your coughing reflex is getting rid of whatever it doesn't like right there. But when you are a tobacco smoker and you are breathing polluted air, your cilia get killed. Absolutely killed. And that means that when you inhale the same dirty air as someone else, you will retain more of it, and it will be able to be kept in your body for longer, and it can, again, depending on the size of the particles, it can get deeply into the lungs. Now, there's another little angle here, which has to do with diesel exhaust. As you may remember, in the 1990s, a scandal was exposed in the late 1990s and early 2000s that all diesel engine manufacturers, not just VW, all diesel engine manufacturers had committed fraud. And it's one of the few situations in environmental pollution where some few people have gone to jail. And the fraud was the diesel engines had been designed so that whenever they were hooked up to a computer, the engine detected that and automatically reduced its emissions, so that it passed emissions of nitrogen oxides and other ultrafine materials, which we know are very damaging to the lung. And so all the diesel engines that are on the road today, because they last a long time, purchased in the late 1990s and later, are able to emit between 40 to 200 times more pollutants than the U.S. standards would allow. Thanks to the California Air Resources Board, that fact became known. And because of that, now they finally have less polluting diesel engines. But basically, because China is very heavily invested in diesel engines, and Italy has lots of diesel engines, and Korea as well, and Iran has old, old engines and polluting things as well, those factors are also contributing to this. So you have high rate of smoking, a high rate of air pollution, fraudulent emitting diesel engines. And then you have something else in China, and that is basic sanitation is pretty lacking. Public toilets often consist of squatting plumbing, where you are not supposed to put tissue, if you can find it, down into the system. That means bathrooms are surrounded with pieces of fecally contaminated toilet paper, and then the water will overflow. It is a sanitation disaster. Now, The Lancet recently published an article showing that COVID-19 virus can be detected in bathrooms at the highest level, except in patient rooms in the hospitals. Why bathrooms? Because it turns out COVID-19 is excreted in feces. And that is very important, and that's a reason why they are shutting public bathrooms. As my colleague, Dr. Robert Morris, has pointed out, it's a huge vector for exposure. finally, adding to all of this is the fact that there's low levels of vitamin D for people at this time of year living in all of those cities where the virus broke out. And vitamin D, as you know, is very, very important as helping to fight viral and any infections. So I don't think that the U.S. is going to be off the hook, but here's what I do think. The rate of death from this virus, as far as we know in Italy, is the highest we've seen anywhere. I think it's close to 10% now, depending on which day you get the data. That is to say, 1 in 10 people who get this will die of it, as far as we know so far. But in China, it's less than that. It seems to be about 4%. The United States, it would not surprise me if we were at 1%. There are countries like Singapore, which and Korea, which had much more stringent policies right away to get on top of this virus, and they seem to be having a much better success as well.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with epidemiologist Dr. Deborah Davis about a lot of facets about the COVID-19 pandemic that we are definitely not getting from our fearless leader in the White House, and a lot of confusion that we've also been experiencing just in the media. Do you know why, at least it was thought, that older people were more susceptible to the virus and more susceptible to getting severe cases and dying?
Well, basically, your lungs, if you took them out of your chest, would take up the area of a tennis court. They're a bunch of folded things packed into that small chest. And after you've lived a long time, your lungs inevitably, like any filter, which is what they are, will accumulate a certain amount of, let's just call it dust, for want of a more technical term. And so as a consequence, the older you get, the harder it is for your lungs, on average, to clear from anything. It's just the nature of life. You lose collagen, which is something that gives you more flexibility. And so the lungs of the elderly have declined in volume. They have declined in elasticity. They've declined in collagen. You have a reduced immune system as you're older as well. Those are just facts of life due to aging. When you add to that this virus, which tends to, unfortunately, for those that get very sick, it creates a kind of clog of the lungs, which in some cases, particularly for those over 80, will not clear very easily. That is why the elderly are at so much greater risk. But again, if you already have asthma, if you have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, if you have hypertension, if you have obesity, all of those things also mean that your lungs are working harder than those of someone your age without those diseases.
I wanted to talk about some of the concerns about workers. Now, you have mentioned that there's a lot of concern at the Boeing plant in Everett, Washington, that people were forced to work in unsafe conditions. There's also stories coming out about Amazon. And I also found out that there's some concerns in some local businesses here in Portland, particularly the Boeing plant in Portland, which is the only Boeing plant that's still open in the West Coast, and also Precision Castparts, which is one of our largest employers. So what are some of the concerns about the safety of workers and what's going on for workers in these businesses that are being considered essential and therefore are being allowed to still operate even at stay-at-home and shelter-in-place orders?
I got a call from a very bright Boeing robotics worker named Graham Davis last week. And he told me the following story. He said that, you know, our building is the largest factory building in the world. He said you need air handling inside to prevent cloud formation from all the exhaled water vapor from people. There are 36,000 people who work under that plant roof. They're building airplanes. Several workers complained that they were being forced, in the nature of the work that they do, to be working too close to one another for safety. His partner was a 70-year-old man with a double lung transplant, and he feared that because he, Graham Davis, is a millennial, he might transmit the virus to this man and potentially could kill him. He said he couldn't live with himself, and he wrote to management and finally stopped going to work. Fortunately, that Boeing plant has stopped operating because they recognized the severity of the problem, but only after one young person had died from COVID-19. So working in close quarters in factories is a risk. And those companies that are requiring that should only be doing so if it's really an urgent matter of national security. And in that case, those workers need to be protected. Just even think about this. Getting back and forth to work, if people take public transportation, there's a risk, unless they stay 6 feet apart and don't touch the surfaces in public transit, which is quite difficult, wash their hands with soap and water when they come out, or wear rubber gloves when they're on public transport. There's really good reason for staying home right now. And the package that was just passed by, what we think is going to be passed by the Congress, will provide people with some funds to compensate for their loss of revenue for not working. Boeing made the right decision, but they really had no choice. And I don't know what the circumstances are in Oregon, but I'd be surprised if they are providing a safe workplace as they need to. There's no way workers can work closely together unless they're given the right protective gear, which is very hard to come by.
Well, actually, I heard an interesting irony. Intel, which has a very large plant just west of Portland, has offered to provide the state, I think, with 1 million gowns and masks and protective gear because that's what they use. I mean, they use very excellent protective gear for their workers, basically to protect the silicone chips and things that they produce. It's not to protect the workers' health usually. So this would be in reverse. At the same time that they're offering all this protective gear to hospitals, I understand that on several of the Intel campuses, there's a lot of concern that they're not keeping workers six feet apart, that in fact, it's impossible for some of these jobs to really work when workers have to be that far apart. Another concern is also with construction, which has not been curtailed in Oregon. So I wonder if you have any sense about what can be done in these situations.
We have to educate management in these situations that they're going to be responsible for their workers' deaths if this continues. Workers cannot be forced to work under conditions that are not safe. Under these conditions right now, I think that any public health expert would tell you it's not safe for people to be working close together now. It just is not. And if there are ways for them to do it separately, if there are ways for people to do framing and working apart from one another and taking precautions, keeping gloves on and it's conceivable, and there may be emergency construction that has to be done, certainly for hospitals. There certainly is. But I think that for anything else that is non-urgent, those things really should be curtailed now.
Well, I think it's interesting to have to assess what's essential in these times. What's your sense of what are essential jobs, essential businesses that should be open, and how do we reconcile that something that seems real important to us is actually kind of frivolous in the state of affairs that we find ourselves in?
Well, grocery stores are innovating by allowing you to order online and then coming to pick up your order. That's one thing that can be done. We have to feed people, but we don't have to have them running around in the grocery store. That's, I think, it can be reduced, it can be eliminated, and it will be safer for everybody. Obviously, emergency medical clinics need to continue operating because there will still be heart attacks and there will still be strokes. And we need our police and fire to be free and able to work. Aside from those basic things of feeding people and taking care of them, I just don't know what else would need to be opened at this time. Stores that are selling merchandise, small businesses, that will adhere to a rigid policy. For example, there's a store here in Jackson, Wyoming, that no more than 10 people can be admitted at any one time. There's lines, they have to stay apart from one another, and they're continuing to sell mountaineering gear, Teton Mountaineering, and they're trying to keep it, those policies in place. There's the local pizza stores. You're not allowed to enter any restaurant physically, but you can order in advance and go pick up your order, and it's brought to you by someone wearing rubber gloves. So those are things that need to be done routinely. And it's hard. I mean, it's hard. It's just hard for people all of a sudden to be indoors more than they have been. There are some benefits for families with children, particularly for those who haven't had a chance as much time. But it's also hard to get any work done when you have little kids. So I think we're going to have to accommodate to this. I think that the signs are encouraging for what's happening in China and Korea now. But I spoke last night to Dr. Richard Cheng, who is in Shanghai, And he says that he's concerned that if they open up things too soon, and they're starting to, that the infection may start to spread again, and we will only know when they do that. I would like to tell you about what Dr. Chang is doing with vitamin C. If there was a family of six adults living in Wuhan, China, upper middle class, they did not live together, but they had an elderly member who had heart disease and diabetes. So they all took turns taking care of her routinely. She developed COVID-19. They all began taking 2 to 6 grams of vitamin C a day. She went into the hospital and was placed on a ventilator. Half the people in her situation that go into the hospital don't come out. She recovered because the family insisted she be given intravenous vitamin C while she was in there, and she got vitamin C intravenously along with the other medications that they give people who are having serious breathing problems, fluids, prednisone, and things to keep the breathing passages open. Not one member of the family that took care of her came down with the virus. They all took care of her, and none of them developed the virus. Now, that is an anecdote, but let me add something to it. In addition to that anecdote, we know from studies that done of healthy military recruits in Korea, done in 2018, 722 of them were given vitamin C to take every day for 1 month, and 722 of them were not. At the end of a month, the ones that took vitamin C every day, just 1 gram, had significantly fewer colds, viral infections, than the others. So now this is considered an important thing to do for prevention, at least in the Korean military. And I would suggest that when military recruits, of course, are under stress, I think that under normal times, hopefully, we get our vitamin C from food. But these are not normal times. These are times when we have to do whatever we can to keep people healthy. So let's figure that out. I think that at this point, we'll have more information on our website, ehtrust.org, about why vitamin C makes sense.
I just wondered about other ways that people can help to boost their immune system. I mean, I've been taking this Chinese herb ever since I first heard about COVID-19, which I take usually when I'm going to get a cold, and it's supposedly an immune system booster, and it's been very helpful to me for many, many years. So I'm just taking that regularly. I'm also taking elderberry syrup, which is also known to boost your immune system. I'm wondering if you have other suggestions for things that people can take that will maybe, if you do take things that are immune system boosters, do you think that that actually can help if you are exposed to this virus?
Sure. And let me just say, the reason I mentioned vitamin C is it's relatively easy, relatively cheap, and you can get it in, you know, many, many different forms. You can even get it as a powder if you go into the pickling section of your, the supermarket. You shouldn't be going to the supermarket, but you can order pickling vitamin C, which is food grade, and it's just a powder. You can mix it in anything, so if the kids don't want it, throw it into the smoothie, and they won't know it's even there. But the other thing is that if you can afford it, then I think people do need additional vitamin D3 at this time of year. Again, because you make it normally from sunlight, but most people are a little deficient in it, and it's very effective against in helping to fight against viral infections. And in addition, we know that probiotics, of course, a healthy gut is very important for all sorts of things. And probiotics and fish oil are both important things as well. But if there was one thing I would pick, it would be vitamin C, between 2 to 6 grams a day. And the way you know if you take too much, you get an upset tummy. And then in addition, vitamin D3, fish oil and probiotics at appropriate levels, more so than you would normally take, again, because you're fighting off an infection. And there are some other things they can do. They can reduce their exposures wherever possible to wireless radiation.
Good luck. We all have wireless in our homes now.
Well, as our website indicates, wireless radiation can affect the ability of the immune system to do its job. It doesn't mean it does all the time, but it can. And so it's very simple to turn your router off at night or make sure you don't go around with your phone on your body, in your pocket, because the manufacturers all advise that a phone is tested off the body and has never been tested directly in contact. This is, again, kind of like the Volkswagen and diesel engine scandal. The fact is that phones are tested in ways that they're not used. And the Chicago Tribune reported recently that when you tested phones directly next to the body, they emitted more than 4 to 10 times more exposure to radiation than the current limits allow. But that's a whole other topic. But I would say that whatever we can do to reduce our exposure, and particularly right now, municipalities all over the country are raising questions about the safety of 5G. And these questions need to be answered before we roll this out all over our country.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with epidemiologist Dr. Deborah Davis, and we're talking about more inside things about the COVID-19 pandemic that I think maybe haven't been mentioned enough in the mainstream media. In the last part of the show, what I'd like to do is talk about sort of looking into the future about their people developing immunity to this and how soon we could see what they call herd immunity. And also the other issue, whether there's actually going to be any kind of vaccines for this.
The disease itself is the vaccine. And by that I mean, if you have got it, and you may not know that you did, and you've recovered, then you are considered to be immune. That's how it normally works. So if, in fact, this disease has gone through our population within the year, we will have more immunity to it. However, viruses are notorious for mutating. They have slippery coats. They disguise themselves. And what we don't know is whether it might come back in a more virulent form. That is what we think happened in the 1918-1919 Spanish flu epidemic. And remember, that was before airplanes. So that was a really fascinating transmission at that time.
But actually, it was like sort of at the end of World War I, too, so there was probably a lot more movement across continents than there might have been.
That's a very good point. That's exactly what it coincided with. And also, people at that point had come out of starvation and terrible conditions, so they were not as strong and healthy as most of your listeners are.
One of the things I wanted to mention, I got an email from this listserv that I'm on for radio producers, and the concern is a lot of us do what's called double enders, where we be recording an interview where the interview subject is, and then the person who's producing the show is on the phone, and then we send the audio to the person who's the producer. So we're not able to do that right now because we are not getting in the same room with the people that we're interviewing for good reasons. So one of the people suggested that if you are a carrier and you go through, you know, having it, you'll have immunity and then it'll be okay and you can go work again. And it seemed to me it was a kind of a glib way of projecting. It sort of sounded like Trump in a way. Oh, this will be over soon and we'll be immune. I wonder what your thoughts are about the efficacy of that.
I can't imagine that that would be a workable situation on a national scale. That's what I would say. And it gets close to a kind of a form of eugenics. You know, we're going to sort of rank people who's safe and who's not safe. And while they did do that in China, and, you know, gave people the red, yellow, and green cards, so to speak, for moving around, I don't imagine that's going to happen in this country. And we have to rely on people. More people have to know enough to do the right thing. And that's why your program is so important, Barbara. We need people to understand we are all in this together, whether we like it or not. We only have one planet, we only have one community in which we live at a time, and we've got to own up to our responsibilities as human beings to do a better job taking care of each other.
One of the things that I've seen about what we're going through now that is a little bit heartening, that I don't think in my experience on the planet all these years I've lived here, that I have seen so many people coming together around the same cause. And I think watching the Senate go through their machinations and agonies to get this bill passed that they finally voted on a couple days ago, and hopefully the House will overcome the one Republican representative obstacle to getting their side of it passed as well. I feel like this is an opportunity for us to try to understand that we are sharing this planet and that we do have some very simple common goals that we can share. I wonder how you see this pandemic as an opportunity for us to make a quantum leap into higher consciousness?
Well, I think we were going to have permanently changed our attitudes toward hand washing after this, because if people really understand how important it is to do it to prevent this, they're going to understand it's going to be important more broadly. So I think that the awareness of hand washing and the awareness of basic hygiene, it's going to have changed the way our world looks at this. We know that, you know, air pollution we've been aware of for some time, and we've also been aware, as you and others have reported for some time, that it doesn't affect all areas equally. That is to say that the worst pollution tends to be in the poorest communities, but not only, right? But that the higher pollution cities for ozone and particulates are really also plagued with many other problems. And people of color and lower income have this unequal pattern, everything from lower both birth weights to higher rates of childhood asthma, et cetera. The point is, we know that these things are controllable. What I think will be different from now on, there's going to be more hand washing for everybody all the time. There's going to be more awareness of the need to take basic precautions in how we transmit things. And I think that that will be very important moving ahead. And it will, we will have changed what's considered normal. It might have been considered unusual for people to bump elbows. It may be that we no longer shake hands, frankly. And many cultures do not shake hands. Many cultures do a little bow, and those are the kinds of things that may well become a part of our new normal, hand-washing and a little bow.
Well, I was reading an article recently about the impact of the flu pandemic in 1918, 1919, and one of the big changes was they no longer had the public cup. I didn't know this, where they'd have like water fountains and there'd be a cup that everybody would share, and they also took away public spittoons. But then a lot of things didn't change after that. People went back to a lot of their same normalcies.
Oh, India has dreadful problems, including the fact that several million people don't use toilets but prefer to defecate outside, considering it healthier. And, of course, we know it's dreadfully polluting. They've got serious problems, and common drinking fountains is one of them. We in the developed world, we have the luxury of not having those problems, but we have to both protect our democracy and make sure that we pay attention to the fact that we're all in this together.
Well, I know you're an epidemiologist and not a political scientist, but how do we protect our democracy from this?
Vote. Make sure everybody votes, and don't think that it's not important. Hold your nose and vote, but vote. That's what I would have to say.
There's actually a very wonderful video that's been circulating on YouTube, which has Anthony Fauci, a gif of him singing a song that's based on the melody of the song Delilah, which is Die, Die, Coronavirus. And one of the things he says over and over at the end is vote, vote, vote.
Is it a total make? They made it up?
They made it up, yeah. I don't know what Fauci's position is on it, but he comes across quite well in it. Actually, the video points out all the contradictions, all the misinformation, all the strange things.
That's one of the things about being a democracy. And now with the internet, it is full of information that's just wrong. It is. And it's very hard. And that's why it's so important for programs like yours to keep getting the attention that you do get.
Thanks very much for joining us, Deborah. And thanks for helping us to find some information to wend our way through what's going on right now. Thanks a lot for being on Lux
Focus. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Today, we've been talking with epidemiologist Dr. Deborah Davis, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our other KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll be talking with Oregon State Representative Karen Power. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. We're going to go out with some music by Beethoven. Stay safe and wash your hands.